Hey there, everybody. It is Wednesday, March 28th, 2012, and you are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm Ken. As always, you can get in touch with us, drop us a line, and send us an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little radio show. And of course, stroll on over to Facebook. Click like us, because we sure as heck like you. Jam-packed, as always, so much to talk about. Hey, first guest, are you ready to go?
Yes, I am.
All right, let me introduce you. And I'm telling you in advance, it's a long introduction, so you just sit back for a while, okay?
Okay.
Okay. Carl Siciliano is a nationally recognized advocate and provider for homeless LGBT youth. He has previously worked with the Catholic Worker Movement, where he assisted in the management of shelters, soup kitchens, and residential programs for the homeless in New York City, Washington, D.C., and Norwalk, Connecticut. He then helped the Neighborhood Coalition for Shelter operate a residential program for homeless adults in New York City, followed by 7 years as the director of homeless youth services for Safe Space NYC Incorporated. During that time, he created an innovative continuum of services for homeless teens, including a 24-hour drop-in center, a citywide street outreach program, a scattered site emergency housing program, and a residential program for HIV-positive teens. The federal government officially designated this program a special project of national significance. In 2002, Carl founded the Ali Forney Center, which has grown to become the nation's largest and most comprehensive housing program for homeless LGBT youth. He has been named by Out Magazine as one of the 100 Outstanding Gay Achievers, and he was the recipient of the Brooke Astor Service Award, which is given to someone who is relentless in his or her dedication to the city of New York and who has contributed substantially to its enrichment. And now he's here with us. Carl Siciliano, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Well, thank you for having me.
That was a lot.
Yeah, it's a little intimidating.
But you did all those things. It can't possibly intimidate you.
Well, it's interesting to hear it all read back at you.
Well, we can do a little pop therapist. How does it make you feel?
I don't know, like I'm out of my body or something. Get this person that doesn't feel like myself.
Well, let's bring you back. Let's bring you back. We love having folks on the show who do nonprofit work, because we have a lot of listeners write in and say, how do I even get into this work? And you've worked in some very specific areas, obviously with homeless populations. How would you answer to someone in Carl Siciliano's Learning Annex how you got into this work?
Well, I don't know that my personal path is like a roadmap for the universe. I was really religious as a teenager. I had like a really intense spiritual experience when I was 15 years old.
Okay.
It kind of came out of nowhere, and I hadn't grown up at all in a religious way, so I, started studying all these different religions, trying to understand what had happened to me. And I don't know, something in my DNA must have made me gravitate towards Catholicism. And I was really responsive to the ideas in the Gospels of, getting rid of your possessions and living in a life of love and mercy and, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. So that's what sort of set me on my way in terms of working with homeless people. I wanted to, live a life of compassion and stuff like that. And got real involved with something called the Catholic Worker Movement.
And then it just kept going from there.
Yeah. When I came out of the closet in my early 20s, like it really put a whole different perspective on the whole Catholic thing. So I, got a lot less identified with that as time went on, but still wanted to do the work. I still wanted to work with people that were poor and suffering and try to alleviate that somewhat.
Gotcha. Well, I mean, it's easy to see that there are, myriad rewards in doing this work, but it's also abundantly clear that this can be draining emotional work that you do. How do you motivate yourself through those times?
You know, I've had some really rough times doing this work.
Yeah.
Especially like kids dying in the streets.
Absolutely.
Ali Forney being one of the ones that I was the closest to. And I have to say that when times get really tough and when I see the kids really suffering, also when I see government really failing to respond to the plight of these kids,
mm-hmm.
I mean, all of that can be really demoralizing and discouraging. Frankly, I think a lot about Ali and the other kids that I knew who died, and I think about how painful and hard that was, and I, in a lot of ways, I use that to motivate me to fight to make things better.
And I know a bunch of folks who work at the Ali Fournier Center, and we've had our good buddy Sharon Staple on the program a few times to talk about her work at the Anti-Violence Project. And one of the things that we hit on last time she was on the air is what qualities do you look for? Because, you know, this is draining work. What qualities do you look for in folks who are applying to work there, who want to do this kind of work?
You know, one of the things that I feel really, really fortunate with is how many wonderful people the Ali Fournier Center has been able to attract to, both work and be volunteers. We really do have like an extraordinary group of people. And I think that for me, what I look for the most is intelligence and compassion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really want somebody who is thoughtful and can respond to the struggles that the young people bring to us, you know, with thoughtfulness and intelligence. But I also really want them to be like open-hearted and kind and good people. It's that combination that we have gotten an awful lot of over the years, and it's something that I'm very, very blessed to have surrounding me.
Well, before we talk about the work of the center, and you've referenced Ali Fournier a couple times, we should tell people, and this was a real person. What can you tell us about Ali Fournier?
I met Ali the day that I started working at Safe Space, which was in 1994. And Ali at that time was 19 years old and had been living on the streets since he was 13. Ali grew up in a housing project in a really rough section of Brooklyn, East New York. And he was very effeminate. And, you know, by the time he was 13 years old, you know, it was obvious to everybody around him that he was gay. And, you know, he lived in this really rough area where people had to really be very aggressive and macho to fit in. You know, the other kids in the housing project would just beat him up all the time. He actually had this dent on the side of his head from a time when they were like chasing him out into the street and he got hit by a car. And his mother didn't know how to cope with the whole situation, and she didn't know how to cope with having a gay kid, and she didn't know how to cope with all the violence, and she threw him out when he was 13 years old. And he spent the next couple of years trying to make it in the foster care system, but he would just get beaten up and bullied and attacked in the foster care system. And so by the time he was 16, he was really, you know, out on the street. And that was a time in New York City when there was nothing like the Ali Fournier Center. There was really only one large shelter for homeless youth, Covenant House, which is a Roman Catholic organization. And back in the 90s, it was just a really violent and rough environment for gay kids. I'll never forget when I first started working at Safe Space, one of the first kids we referred to Covenant House for shelter came back the next day and said he would never go back there. And I asked him why, and he said that they put him in a dorm with 14 other kids, and when he went to bed, they all gathered around him and urinated on him to show how much they hated having a gay kid in their dorm.
Wow.
So, I mean, it was just really impossible for the gay kids to go there. And so Ali and the other LGBT youth who were on the streets just were really out there on the streets. They pretty much all survived through prostitution. They were all becoming addicted to drugs, you know, as they tried to just cope with how painful their lives were. Every couple of months, one of them would die.
Wow.
Usually, you know, being shot or stabbed or something in the streets. Usually, you know, through like unsafe prostitution situations. So it was just a really, really brutal situation that Ali was in. Homeless kids tend to feel under attack and under siege in so many ways, and they build a lot of armor around themselves, and they're pretty emotionally guarded. And Ali didn't have that. He was just really open and really, like, if Ali cared about you, he let you know in no uncertain terms. He was just a really loving kid, both with the folks that worked with him and with the other kids on the street. He really created a sense of community. One of the things that he was notorious for was, you know, he was an HIV peer educator, so he would go out onto the streets with our street outreach workers and you know, teach other people about keeping themselves safe from HIV infection. And I'm sure, as you can imagine, you know, these homeless kids surviving through prostitution, you know, just had astronomical HIV infection rates. They did, and they still do. And even when Ali's peer education stint ended, he would come every day to our drop-in center and just pick up dozens and dozens and dozens of condoms in a little knapsack, and he would just take them out every day to all the other kids who were prostituting on the streets and educate them about how to keep themselves safe, even when he wasn't being paid to do it. And then in the mid-90s, like 96, 97, something, you know, kind of catastrophic happened for the homeless kids, and especially the LGBT kids in New York City, which was when Times Square got really fixed up and Disney-fied and all that. The police got really aggressive about pushing them out of that neighborhood at night, and a lot of them started going up to places like Harlem and the South Bronx, and there just wasn't nearly as much of a cultural understanding of what it meant for, like, a transgender homeless kid to be prostituting, and
right.
A lot of these kids then got killed. Like, that was when we saw the real wave of deaths. And Ali was really close with two of the young people that were murdered, Dion Webster and Kiki Freeman. And he was really aggressive about going to the police precincts and demanding that they investigate the murders of his friends and bringing them clues and stuff like that. And, I mean, you have to understand, Ali was like... Ali would be dressed as a boy part of the day and dressed as a girl part of the day. His boy name was Ali. Her girl name was Luscious. You know, Ali would go into these precincts wearing, like, thigh-high leather boots and, like, these blonde George Washington ponytail wigs and still demand to be taken seriously. And I was always just really moved by his courage and his compassion and his sense of valuing these kids that so few people valued at all. And when Ali was murdered in December of 97, oh my God, I was just so devastated.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we would have these funerals for the kids, these memorial services in a church next door to where our drop-in center was. And usually it would be like, you know, 10 or 15 people huddled up in some little side chapel. When Ali died, you know, we had to open up the main church because so many people came.
Right.
Ali just really touched a chord in an awful lot of people in the city. And a lot of the folks that did the work, you know, who ran, like, you know, the handful of programs that there were for homeless kids were just devastated when he died.
Yeah.
And we had, like, you know, 100 people at his memorial service.
So how do you get from this just incredible youth and this tragic ending to actually setting up a center? You know, we have so many folks on the show who talk about working in an already established organization. You started the organization. How do you get from the idea of it to it actually happening?
Well, you know, as I was looking at what was happening and absorbing it and thinking about what it meant, you know, I was just really struck that there was like these layers of profound failure that were impacting these kids' lives. You know, first their parents were failing to be parents to their kids. Like, they weren't able to accept their gay kids.
Right.
And throwing them out, which is, you know, just a profound failure. And then it seemed to me that the city and the state and the public policy people were just really failing to see the needs of these kids and really failing to respond. You know, what was really striking for me, especially in those days before there was a sense that AIDS was even a treatable disease, was, you know, these kids were all getting infected with HIV, and I just thought it was a public health disaster that there were no beds for these kids, you know, because it was really forcing them into situations where they were, you know, prostituting themselves to survive. And it just seemed to me like it was a real engine of HIV infection, this failure to provide the kids with just the very basic necessities. And then, so that seemed like a real failure. And then, you know, frankly, in the late 90s, there was no consciousness of this issue in the LGBT community. You know, the kids were ashamed of what was happening to them, and they weren't walking around with signs saying, you know, we're homeless LGBT youth, do
right.
something for us.
Help us, yeah.
They would never say that. And there just wasn't, like, an awareness within the LGBT community, and I felt like if the LGBT community wasn't advocating for these kids and wasn't standing up and demanding that they be protected, like, who would?
Right.
So, you know, when I thought about all that and reflected on all of it, and especially when I thought about how New York City was, like, the birthplace of the gay rights movement and, you know, had such a strong LGBT community, it just seemed shameful to me that these kids were out on the street with no help. You know, I spent, like, a couple of years just complaining, why isn't the LGBT community doing anything? And then I thought, well, maybe I'm, like, the part of the LGBT community to do something and stop complaining.
You're one of us.
Yeah. So, So in January of 2002, I decided to start the Ali Frenet Center, and within a couple of months, I had gotten a church that was giving us the use of their basement, and one donor, Henry Van Ameringen, gave a check for $37,000. So with that, we got started, and we started with six cots in this church basement. And the day we opened, we were turning away 20 kids who wanted to be in those six cots. And within a few weeks, we were turning away 100 kids a night.
Wow. That's got to be so tough, because you've obviously identified the need. You knew, I'm sure you had a sense, that's what was going to happen. And yet at the same time, the need outweighs your capacity.
Yeah, well, it's always outweighed our capacity.
Yeah.
By last October, our waiting list every night had grown to over 200.
Oh, my
gosh.
Which
is the highest it's ever been. It's a little lower now because not so many kids kind of hit the streets or will come to New York in the middle of the winter. But
right.
So the winter tends to be. Now, I think last time I looked, our waiting list was 118. But, yeah, in New York City, there was a census done in 2008 that showed that there were 3,800 homeless kids, 1,600 of them, about 40%, are LGBT. And in New York City right now, there are about 250 youth shelter beds. So, I mean, you know, really, for every one kid that has a bed, there are 10 kids that don't.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, we're dealing with a real serious situation. And it's part of what you have to be able to deal with to do the work is to not accept, but recognize the fact that a daily part of it is the inadequacy of what you're able to provide.
So, gosh, I mean, I have all these other questions, but I feel like the only question running through my head right now is, all right, so what do we do? You know, we're hearing this and there's such a need. What do we do? What can we do to help?
You know, I really think that you know, when I think about what the LGBT community can do to help, that there are kind of three things that really jump out at me. The first is people have to be aware. You know, they just have to understand what the situation is. And I still don't think that there's enough of that.
Right.
I don't think that our leading organizations, our leading advocacy organizations that are sort of fighting for LGBT rights see enough yet that hundreds of thousands of kids being put out of their homes and deprived of the love and support of their families is like probably the most profound expression of homophobia in our times,
yeah.
The most terrible, the cruelest. So I think that within the community, there has to be like an awareness and an education about what these kids are going through and what our responsibility to them is before anything can happen.
Right.
You know, because I just think that if the LGBT community isn't standing up for these kids and demanding that they be protected, like, it's never going to happen.
Right.
So that's the first, is like promoting awareness. So, you know, to that, you're doing this broadcast is great. So thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm ready for step two.
Okay.
We got that part down. We're good at that part. I want more.
Okay. Step two is people have to identify the programs that are serving our kids and support them. You know, government is not being responsive to the needs of our kids. And there's a lot of a sense in which we as a community have to stand together and protect our own. And I really look back to the early days of our communities fighting HIV as sort of a blueprint. I mean, you know, government was not helping us, and we really banded together and created programming and support for the people that were suffering so much in our community. So, you know, one thing that I would recommend is going to the Ali Frenet Center's website, alifrenetcenter.org. That's Alifroney Center, Center.org. And we have a page called Resources, and what we've done is we've compiled information about all the programs around the country that work with homeless LGBT youth. So I would really recommend that people, you know, learn about what's available in their states and their cities and their areas for homeless youth, for homeless LGBT youth, and see what they can do to support them. I mean, we're all operating on a terrible shoestring, and we are all overwhelmed by the disparity between the resources that we have and the enormous need that's out there.
Right.
And then I think that the third thing that folks have to do is that there has to be like a political engagement and a political involvement in demanding that our kids be protected. I think that people need to educate themselves about what their localities are doing for homeless LGBT youth, which is probably nothing.
I was going to say, because only 17 states are represented there on the resources page.
Right.
And it's not to say that there might not be some local programs that don't rise to that level, but you have to imagine there's a lot of states that just aren't providing these services.
Right. And you need to, like, identify politicians that are likely to be supportive and go to them and say, you know, there are these kids on the streets of our city. You know, there are so many gay kids being put out. And, you know, how are we going to get the resources? In New York City, you know, another thing you could look at on our website is we have a page for the Campaign for Youth Shelter. And that's something that we formed in New York City to really kind of mobilize the LGBT community to get together and to fight for our kids. So in New York, as I mentioned, we have 250 beds and 3,800 homeless kids. And the Campaign for Youth Shelter is something that I founded, and I'm working closely with a number of other providers and gay rights advocacy groups like the Empire State Pride Agenda, mm-hmm. Queer Rising, and you know, we've been approaching progressive churches, we've been approaching LGBT political clubs and progressive political clubs, we've been approaching the business community, we've been approaching the media, all trying to create a sense of understanding of the plight of these kids and getting people to support a plan to house them. So what we've articulated in New York is that we want to see a plan to add 100 beds a year until such time as there's no longer waiting lists for the shelter beds. And that might sound really paltry compared to the need, but the reality is that there are usually about 10 kids a year who stay in a bed. So if we added 100 beds a year, it would be serving an additional 1,000. So we've been going to Albany, we've been going to City Hall, we've been really pushing our elected officials to be more responsive. And, you know, I think that's the third thing. It's just a political engagement in terms of our kids. So, you know, I think that one thing that people could do in different localities would be, you know, to find like their LGBT community centers or, you know, wherever there's a center of support and service for their community. And look at how are the kids being served or not served in that local community, and then you know, articulate a response.
And maybe not just engaging our political leaders, but engaging our religious leaders as well.
Well, I think that's a huge dimension of this. There was a study done by the University of San Francisco that came out about 2 years ago on family acceptance and family rejection. The group that does it at the University of San Francisco is called the Family Acceptance Project. And they found that parents that identified as strongly religious were 4 times more likely to reject their kids for being LGBT. So like religious intolerance is a huge contributor to this crisis.
Right.
Of so many thousands of kids being on the streets just because of who they are.
Is there anyone in particular that you would maybe like to write a letter to, or perhaps that you already have written a letter to?
Well, I had a letter published in the Huffington Post about a week ago to Cardinal Dolan. Cardinal Dolan is the Archbishop of New York City and of the New York Archdiocese, and he's the president of the Catholic Conference of Bishops. So he's arguably one of the most influential religious leaders in the country. And he's just been really strident in his opposition to gay equality. You know, he was having meltdowns about the passage of gay equality in New York. He compared it to the crucifixion of Christ. You know, he's given interviews where he compares being gay to being an alcoholic.
Right.
He says that the state recognizing our marriage equality is like the action of communist China. I mean, he's just spoken in this really kind of hysterical way that you know, makes being gay seem unbelievably terrible and evil. And, you know, so what I wanted him to understand is, what does that do to the parents who believe in him?
Right.
I think that under the best of circumstances, it's anxiety provoking and fearful for a lot of parents to know what this means and to know how to cope with it. And to have religious leaders demonizing the acceptance of gay people you know, what does that do to parents? It makes them so much less able to accept their own kids.
Right.
And I think it's just a tragedy. And I think it's, you know, look, I used to be a monk. I used to be part of the Catholic worker movement. I've studied the Bible many, many, many times. And I think it's not just terrible from a human rights perspective, you know, and from a, you know, sociological perspective of the damage that it does. But I even think it's terrible from a spiritual perspective.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the core message of the Gospels that Jesus is teaching is that God's love for us is like the unshakable love of a parent for their child. And to have religious leaders act in a way in the name of this Jesus who taught of a loving God, of who is like a loving parent who would never abandon their children, and promote them to abandon their children, you know, it's just, I find it mind-bogglingly wrong and shameful.
So what I hear you saying is that as a former monk, you are telling us that the communist China analogy is not to be found in the Bible?
No.
Okay.
No, I mean,
we're going to take your word for it.
Thank you.
We'll take your word for it.
And treating gay people as equal does not equate to the crucifixion of Christ. You know, it's like the two have nothing to do with each other.
I'm just a gay Jew from New Jersey. I need to take your word for it on these things.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like, I don't know what's up with these religious leaders that need to have their enemies. I mean, it's like, yeah, you know, 50 years ago, it was the Jews, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, they would do all, you know, I just think, like, God, didn't they learn from that?
But unfortunately, what we've learned is that it also leads to increased donations for various religious organizations.
Well, I guess it heightens your profile or something.
Yeah, something like that. It gets you more likes on Facebook, and that's really what it's all about, Carl. Well, we do have to talk about your musical selections for this week's episode.
Sure.
So this is the part of the show, Carl, where you tell our listening audience what, and we'll only do a couple of them, what a couple of your musical selections say about Carl Siciliano. It's a little self-analysis for our listening audience. You ready?
Sure.
What does Lowe's Silver Rider say about Carl? I don't even know that one.
Okay, well, it's a beautiful song. It might have more prominence now because Robert Plant covered it on his most recent album, Band of Joy.
Okay.
But Lowe is a like sort of an alternative group. They're called Slowcore, part of a movement called Slowcore, which is like this really kind of slow, intense music. And, you know, I'm not sure what they meant when they wrote Silver Rider, but when I listen to that song when I'm looking to get inspired, when I'm looking to give a speech and hoping to inspire folks to a greater understanding and compassion of what homeless kids are going through. And it's hard for me to explain what it is about the song that does that. I think you just have to listen to the song. But there's something like heroic and inspirational about the song, what it's speaking to.
All right.
And so when I'm trying to like gear myself up to be heroic and inspirational, I often listen to Silver Rider.
And then I'll let you choose. Would you like to talk about the Depeche Mode song or the Al Green song? So different.
Talk about. I guess it's a hard choice. I'm just going to very quickly say that the Depeche Mode song was on the radio when Ali died.
Oh,
and,
wow!
Know, clubs and you know it's no good. It just reminds me of that time.
Yeah.
I mean, I also think it's like a really cool kind of propulsive song.
Yeah.
Al Green. I've loved Al Green for many years. I think he's got the sexiest voice on the planet. I'm often trying to reconcile my sexual side and my spiritual side.
Okay.
You know, like I think that in our society, and I think that in the kind of Judeo-Christian tradition, there's this kind of split between the body and the soul.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want that split in my life. Like, you know, I want a body and a soul.
Yeah.
And there's something about Al Green where he just, you know, kind of fuses the two together in a way that I don't hear people do very often. Also, in a very personal way, like the kids all knew that I loved Al Green. I had like pictures of Al Green in my office at Safe Space and stuff. And so Ali would do this talent show. We had a talent show every year, and Ali would always be the star of it. And the year that he died, Ali actually wanted to, he informed me of this the day before the show. He wanted me to lay my head in his lap, and he wanted to drop rose petals on me while serenading me with an Al Green song.
To which you said,
no, I said, Ali, are you out of your mind? You know, I didn't want to make people think that I was like getting into, you know, romantic relationships with the kids, which was, you know, the last thing from my mind.
So you're saying that you have boundaries.
Yeah, I have boundaries.
Boundaries are good.
It's appropriate to show boundaries. And, I mean, at this point, we were only a few years removed from the big scandal where Father Ritter, the founder of Covenant
right.
House, was found to, you know, have, you know, had all these kids living with him in his private penthouse.
Yeah.
Sex toys. So, you know, that was the last thing I wanted to make people think I was, you know, trying to do. So I wouldn't let Ali do it. But then, you know, after he died, I just, you know, there was a part of me that felt badly that I wouldn't let him do it because, you know, it was an expression. I mean, you know, for him, I think he was trying to express how much he cared about me and was grateful for, you know, what I'd done for him.
So, mm-hmm.
I mean, when I hear Al Green, that always comes to mind.
That does it. That does it. Well, in case folks missed the link earlier, give us the link again to the center.
It's alifornecenter.org, alifornecenter.org.
And we should be clear, although raising awareness and challenging political leaders and identifying programs, these are all important things to do, we would not dissuade someone from going to that site and perhaps donating some money, would we?
No, we wouldn't at all. And something that folks should understand is that while we're in New York City, we are by far the largest provider of beds, and kids from all over the country come to us. Fewer than half of our kids are from New York City.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
More than half of the kids come to us are from other states. I would say that there's a preponderance of kids from the red states who come to us.
Yeah.
I think the kids are more likely to be rejected from their homes in more conservative areas. You know, we're very much responding to a national crisis and not just to a local crisis.
Well, I know you work with an incredible team of folks there with just some really inspiring youth who need assistance and who are enormously, enormously grateful for the support that you're providing. It's not hard to do the end tagline for this interview because it's the work you're doing just speaks for itself. But I hope you know how much the entire community appreciates this really vital work for a population that really needs support that is so can be so marginalized and so not named by the rest of the community, and you're putting a name on it even as you're providing the services. It's so vital.
Well, thank you. That's a really kind thing to say.
And you're going to keep doing it?
I don't have plans to do anything else.
All right, then let's go with this. Carl, an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Please keep doing this important work.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, all the best.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye, Carl.
All right, folks, and we are back. Hello, Jodelia.
Why, hello there, Kenneth.
It always seems to be a while.
Yes, it is.
We haven't sat here for at least a month, and we have so much gay news to talk about and not all that much time to do it. So we got a book.
We
got a book like a rainbow. Do they book?
I don't know.
They book. They move really fast, those rainbows. It's the speed of light. Hey, there was a poll. We haven't even done a poll question in a while.
Oh.
So one of the national polls that was out there this week, the question was, Jody, it's always weird when it says your name.
It's
Jody,
so funny.
How often do you donate to LGBT political causes or campaigns? Here are your five choices. One, at least monthly. Two, occasionally, but not regularly.
Mm-hmm.
Three, I usually give at least one gift a year.
Mm-hmm.
Four, I don't give to LGBT political causes. And my favorite one, number five, not sure. Which, that category makes sense sometimes for other polls. Not so much for this one.
Not really.
Unless it's like a subtle organization that you didn't even know they did LGBT work.
Right, right, right. Or you just are really bad with your money and you have no idea where it goes.
Oh, maybe I'm not sure. So which category are you?
I regularly order checks that have the HRC logo on them.
I've seen those. You use those at the Chelsea Royal Diner.
I do.
Yes, they take checks.
Yes.
Not credit cards, though.
No, no, they do not. So I guess because some proceeds do go to them, every time we order checks, we end up giving to that cause.
Okay.
So it's at least a few times a year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the plurality, 37.4%, said at least monthly, which I found to be fascinating.
Wow.
And then 28.5%, I usually give at least one gift a year.
Mm-hmm.
27%, I'm rounding now, occasionally but not regularly. 5.5%, I don't give to LGBT political causes.
Mm-hmm.
And 1.6%, not sure. They're not sure.
They're bad with their money.
So if folks want to go back and listen to the episode where we had Jimmy Nguyen on the first time, that was his op-ed on advocate.com all about people giving to LGBT organizations. And, you know, it didn't measure, the study that he cited didn't measure people giving nationally, but the question was, are people giving more locally? I would give, if we had more opportunities for LGBT organizations locally, I probably would give more.
I mean, I guess it would depend on the group, too.
Yeah.
If they had their act together, if their mission was really clear.
Oh, you have, like, criteria. My criteria is gay.
No, I really need them to know what they're doing and communicate it well.
I need them to be gay.
Oh, that's nice.
Yes, that's my criteria. All right, news stories. Now, our good buddies over at the National Organization for Marriage, how much in checks have you given them this year?
None.
Okay. That's probably a good idea.
Yeah.
There's this internal document. I'm not clear if it got leaked or if they released it, which, knowing them, they might have released it because they're that bold and brash.
That's true.
They have a December 2009 internal document called National Strategy for Winning the Marriage Battle. And this document details efforts to drive a wedge between gays and both African-American and Latino communities. It's right there in their document.
Wow.
As well as energizing clergy opposed to gay marriage. So these are some quotes from the document. Quote, the Latino vote in America is a key swing vote and will be so even more so in the future, both because of demographic growth and inherent uncertainty. Will the process of assimilation to the dominant Anglo culture lead Hispanics to abandon traditional family values? We must interrupt this process of assimilation by making support for marriage a key badge of Latino identity, a symbol of resistance to inappropriate assimilation. By the way, someone please do a demographic study of how many Latino members they have there at the National Organization for Marriage. So the fact that this organization is seeking to make an impact on the key badge of Latino identity, that's ridiculous.
Wow.
Also from this document, quote, we aim to find, equip, energize, and connect African-American spokespeople for marriage to develop a media campaign around their objections to gay marriage as a civil right. Wow. I don't know. I would actually like to believe that this group released it themselves and that it didn't leak, because
right.
It's pretty consistent with how they are too.
Yeah.
Is that okay if I say they?
Sure. They are a they.
They are a they.
They definitely are one of those theys.
So that's what's going on there with Nam. And they have millions of dollars. People give to them. People give a lot of money to them.
Ugh.
But not you.
No.
Yeah, me neither.
No.
Now, if they said gay.
Would you be giving to them?
Maybe.
They do. They say the word gay a lot.
But they are not indeed gay. Although they have all these folks who say that they were gay. But now
but
they're
that's
not anymore.
Those
are
something.
The ex-gays.
Yeah.
The film Bully. Have you heard about the film Bully?
Little bits, but not lots.
Gina and I talked about it. Oh, you haven't met Gina. Gina is our newest co-host.
Oh,
she
cool.
was on a few weeks ago. We recorded from, oh my gosh, was that going to sound sketchy? I'll finish the sentence. We recorded from a hotel bed in Phoenix.
That does sound sketchy.
Sorry, Gina. I had fun. So we talked about there was this whole movement to the Motion Picture Association of America, who does the ratings. We're going to rate the movie R. And then all these celebrities and a lot of other folks got on the bandwagon of saying, hey, don't rate this movie R.
Uh-huh.
And so it is now going to be it's going to be unrated.
Oh.
Because they couldn't get it down to PG-13.
Hmm.
So the controversial documentary Bully will be released without a rating, prompting director Lee Hirsch to say he knows, quote, kids will come, so it's up to the theaters to let them in. Entertainment Weekly reports the film, which looks at the bullying epidemic in the American school system, will be released in LA and New York this coming Friday without a rating, which means theater owners will then be able to make decisions on who will be permitted to see the film. I'm really excited to see it.
Mm.
I watched a clip of it today, and it is.
Is it really good?
Well, you know,
who
can even determine if things are good when they're that heart-wrenching?
Right, right.
So
well done.
Heart-wrenching, yeah. There's a clip that they released of this mother confronting her son, perhaps care-fronting him, and saying these kids who are beating up on you are not your friends. They're not your friends. And
right.
he just says, well, if they're not my friends, then I don't have any friends. Oh. And then there's a pause. So it ripped me apart a little bit. It ripped me apart a little bit. Pat Robertson. Why are you chuckling? You watch that show all the time. The 700 Club. When was the last time you watched the 700 Club? There's no way it's never.
In the history of never?
No, come
never.
On.
Never.
You've
I've never watched
never
it.
Never seen the 700
no.
Club? Oh, I watch it every morning. So yesterday's broadcast of the 700 Club found televangelist Pat Robertson, he was in top form. He said homosexuality, quote, is somehow related to demonic possession.
Please,
somehow. A lot. Lesbians have hooves. Robertson's comments came during a segment profiling an ex-gay man who once, I love this quote, who once, quote, trolled the streets longing for cheap sex with other men. As the religious right figure put it, while his wife remained clueless about this aspect of his life. That's the wife of the ex-gay, not the wife of
right.
Pat Robertson.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh,
so
yeah.
somehow related to demonic possession.
Hmm.
Huh. You know what the word for demonic possession is in Swedish?
No.
Lefsa. It's true. I looked it up.
Uh-huh.
Now, the question is, this is actually where I wanted to go with this. In the Huffington Post, when we had Noah Michelson on the show last week, who's the editor of the Gay Voices section in the Huffington Post,
mm-hmm.
they have a section there on the Huffington Post. They have a regular article. I want to say it's called Know Thine Enemy, and where
okay.
they profile different like National Organization of Marriage, and
right.
with the goal of that we need to know about these folks and what they're saying.
Sure.
So shouldn't you, Jody, then be watching the 700 Club?
Or rather, should I instead be reading the Huffington Post?
Ah. But that's not a direct source.
No, it's not.
And as a college administrator, you're supposed to be encouraging students to go to original sources.
Except I'm not a news analyst who has this as a career, and I don't have gobs and gobs of time.
Okay.
So if I'm going to fill my time with a lot of different things, most of those things are going to be things that I find fulfilling and worthwhile. And
which apparently does not include RuPaul's Drag Race. And don't think that I'm ever over that, nor that I will stop bringing that up every single time we sit here in the sound studio.
No, instead, I've started to watch the Sherlock series, which is
it's quite brilliant.
Yeah,
it's quite brilliant. I enjoy that. And there's a lot of homoeroticism between Sherlock and Watson.
Well,
there's
I think
a lot going on there.
Didn't he say he's gay, basically, in the first episode?
No.
I thought he did.
Oh,
I thought
we got to go back.
I thought
All right,
he inferred. Watson sort of says something about, like, by the way, it's all okay, as in, if you are gay and everything else. And Sherlock says, yes, I know.
Huh. Well, if folks saw that he was gay and I totally missed it, send an email to Jody@thisshowisogay.com and she will collect that data.
Yeah, I'm under the impression data. That he admitted to being gay, but completely uninterested in anything except for his work.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I don't watch, so I should say, I lied earlier. I actually don't watch the 700 Club.
I'm shocked.
I'm a liar.
So shocking.
I'm a liar. And I think that my lies are connected to my demonic possession.
I was just going
to
say.
Yeah. As we Jews are. But, but I don't know. There's sometimes when I kind of want to watch it because it bolsters something.
Well, I don't really know what. It's certainly, yeah, you can see, wow, yes, they are as out there as people who do these news analyses say they are.
Right.
So, yes, I think on occasion, you can do that. And in order to fact check a little bit, if you really want to be a wise consumer of news analysis. However, I'm not going to spend all of my time doing that.
Not even a part of your time?
Not really.
Okay. Now, let's talk from demonic possession. Obviously, that transitions right nicely into Kirk Cameron. Now, I called your wife.
Uh-huh.
You were a huge Kirk Cameron fan. Said you used to have his poster up.
I had one poster.
I totally made that up. You really did?
I really did.
You had a Kirk Cameron poster?
Yeah, in like fifth grade.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I love lying as consistent with my demonic possession. And it turns out to elicit the truth. So you were a regular reader there of Tiger Beat.
No, 16.
16.
I had 3 issues and that was pretty much it.
Wow. Yeah, so yeah, Kirk Cameron, have you been following Kirk Cameron's comments?
No, I have not.
Have you not heard about Kirk Cameron at all?
I've heard a little bit. He's kind of gone a little off the deep end.
Gina and I talked about this on a bed in a hotel in Phoenix. And just want to keep referencing that because it'll really help her work as a social worker with kids with cancer. It's really what she does. So Kirk Cameron, yes. So he made some anti-gay remarks to Piers Morgan tonight. He told host Piers Morgan that being gay is, quote, detrimental and ultimately destructive, and that he would not be supportive if one of his 6 sons told him he was gay. And I said at the time on the show that I actually don't put a lot of stock in the story because let's blame Kirk Cameron. And certainly I do, and I don't support anything that he said. But I also know that that Piers Morgan knew exactly what he was going to say.
Mm-hmm.
Kirk Cameron has been not at all shy in the past about his views on homosexuality. So let's also say that, and Kirk Cameron is not in the public consciousness now, that
not
he
really.
Is a relevant figure to be having on Piers Morgan's show, who theoretically features people who have some cultural significance right now. So Piers Morgan knew that this question was going to be asked because he asked it and he wrote it, and he knew that's what the answer was going to be, and he got traction out of it. So I just want to, fine, let's blame Kirk Cameron, and I disagree with what he said, but let's also blame Piers Morgan, who totally did this as a rating stunt.
Yeah, that seems likely.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So there's that. So then this weekend was the GLAAD Media Awards, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation's, their media awards in New York City. And Tracy Gold, who I had a poster of, I totally didn't, but I had one of John McEnroe, and that's kind of the same. She played, that's horrible. She played, if you don't know, she played Kirk Cameron's sister on Growing Pains.
That's right.
Now, she was up there on the podium, and she told attendees that Cameron had spoken his mind, and then she added, I want my voice of love and support to be louder. There's nothing wrong with being gay. And the mention of Kirk Cameron's name set off a loud round of boos from the audience.
Ooh-wee.
Boo. And then her co-presenter, Carson Kressley, he cheered Gold, and he said, go, Tracy. He then added, quote, just for the record, I don't like Kirk Cameron's hair. Which I just thought was great. Because I think that that's really the cultural analysis that I'm, honestly, that I'm looking for from Carson Kressley.
Well, yes,
that's
basically
what I'm looking for. So that's what's going on in the media. And of course, it would not be a Jody and Ken segment without talking about an education story.
Yes.
A suburban Atlanta high school student says in a federal lawsuit that administrators removed him as student body president after he promoted changes aimed at making the prom more inclusive to gay students.
Huh.
Ruben Lack, a senior at Alpharetta High School, filed the lawsuit this week at a U.S. District Court in Atlanta. He's asking for an injunction reinstating him as student body president. He said he introduced a resolution at a January student council meeting to modify the school's prom king and queen tradition to make it more inclusive to gay students. He suggested several options, including changing it to a prom court, very good idea, mm-hmm. so that a same-sex couple could be elected. He says he was told by school officials on February 8th that he was immediately removed from his position for, quote, pushing personal projects and advocating policy changes, and the school system disputes his allegations. And this is from the spokesperson, Samantha Evans, from the Fulton County Schools. She said, quote, the principal and teachers at Alpharetta High were very careful to take great care and be fair to all students involved when making the leadership change for this student body position. This student was relieved from his position because he failed to complete his responsibilities according to set bylaws, nothing more. We assure you that no one at Alpharetta High School has made any decision that would be considered biased or prejudiced.
That's such bullshit.
I will bleep that yeah. out, Jody.
I'm
I think
sorry.
That's the first time you've ever cursed on
I'm
this show.
I'm sorry. That just really gets me.
He said he was called to a meeting and led to believe it would be about meeting times and scheduling of student events. And then he was told he was being removed from his position. I think the best way to describe it is an ambush, he said in an interview last Friday.
Yeah.
And he said that he decided to make the prom proposal after seeing news stories about gay students across the country who felt excluded from school activities and had committed suicide in some cases.
The thing that gets me the most is that he was removed from office. There's the personal agenda and then for proposing policy changes. What is a student council there for? Are they not an advisory body that then gives advice on policy changes? Isn't that what they're for? Isn't that mm-hmm. what they do?
Theoretically.
So him proposing that is in fact complying with what his position is doing.
Well, they're saying that that's not why he was removed, that he was removed because he didn't complete his responsibilities, which is a really vague phrase, and we
that's
don't know what
that means.
That's completely
vague. We don't even know what
they
that means.
They could say it's because he was obligated to show up at the bake sale, and he didn't show up at the bake sale, or he was supposed to show up at the car wash, and he didn't show up at the car wash. I mean, it could be something. They could be, but of course they didn't say that. They're keeping it pretty vague.
I will not repeat my bleeped expletive, but the intention of that bleeped expletive is inserted in this place.
Yeah. There you
Jeez.
Go. There you go.
Ah!
Who'd you go to prom with?
I went...
Oh, no. Why are you sighing?
Well, he was very nice, but it was definitely sort of a, oh, well, you could go with this guy. It'll be okay. And he was very nice. But it was...
Do you not talk to him anymore?
No.
You're not Facebook friends?
No. I have no idea where he is.
But you know his name.
Yeah.
Okay, can you make the commitment to friend him by the end of the day?
No.
Okay. I'm friends with Mandy Filer. Shout out, Mandy Filer. We went to prom together. I'm gay now. and I was gay then. But I had a really good time with Mandy Filer.
I had a miserable time at my prom.
Oh.
It was a miserable time. I really
You should totally go to the prom with Mandy Filer.
Sure.
That would have been a whole different story.
Yeah. It was, and it had nothing to do with my prom date. He was a very nice
You're
guy.
You're so studiously not saying his name, yeah. which is fascinating.
Yeah.
Who did your lovely wife go to her prom with?
Oh, gosh, I don't know.
You see, these are the kind of things you need to know in order to be in a relationship. I'm just saying.
I see. I can't remember. And I also can't remember if she indeed had a prom, or if it was some
Do they even
kind of
have
final.
Proms
they
in
had,
Minnesota?
Well, it wasn't that. It's, she went to the arts high school there, the Parker okay. Center for the Arts. So I don't remember if they have like a prom in the traditional sense, or if they had some sort of more like a senior dance kind of thing. I'll have to ask her because they
might not have had a prom. It might have been like celebrate the Norseman night.
It could have been something yes. more like that. So I can't remember if she did in fact have a prom date or if it was more like a
Lefse Limbo night.
Lefse Limbo.
Some sort of activity
yes,
based
yes,
thing.
Or something. Yeah. I will ask her.
Okay. And we'll bring that back to a yeah. future show.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, that actually brings us to the end of our time. We certainly, certainly want to thank Carl Siciliano for being on the show earlier.
Definitely.
Amazing work. Amazing work there at the Ali Fornay Center in New York City. Please support them or one of your local organizations, or do what he did and start your own organization. Find out if your community helps, does something to help LGBT homeless youth.
Mm.
And as we said earlier, only 17 states, it seems, do indeed do something to help LGBT homeless youth. So Jeez. That leaves I don't know, something like 33 other states that don't. So
yeah.
You likely are in one of those 33 states, so go do something. As always, drop us an email. Let's say this week, send it on over to Jody at thisshowisogay.com. Of course, stroll on over to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us. You know why, Jody?
Because that's a good thing to do.
Because we like you.
Yeah.
You never heard? You got to listen to the start of the show one day.
Sorry.
It's what we say. And go to thisshowisogay.com. We have a ton of guests coming up, including a very, very exciting one that I can't announce until next week, but it's very, very exciting.
That's a teaser.
I know.
Huge teaser.
I know. And it's not like one of those, oh, okay, it's just someone Ken knows. Because last time I said that, it was my mom. And people were like, that wasn't so. But it was so exciting because my mom was great. So do all those things and go start an organization and go make some lefse and go to your prom and shout out Mandy Filer. She's getting a lot of play on this week's show.
She
which
is.
Very, very exciting. And while you're doing all of those amazing things, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay? If you're broken down, Jesus is ready. Oh, yeah. Ah, don't let your sister down. Yeah. Standing right there behind you, helping you. Yeah, yeah. Jesus is waiting. Oh. Do I have to say it again? Say it again. I think I want to say it again. Say it again. Jesus is waiting. Yeah. Talking about you've got a friend. Help me, help me, help me.